This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 105 of Literary Disco, Brat Pack America. Today's episode is all Reagan and Pepsi and Wax On, Wax Off, as we take a nostalgic tour of the teen films of the 1980s with Kevin Smokler's book, Brat Pack America. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong, joining me in person.
Live.
I think this might actually be the first time we've recorded in person without it being a stage show.
It is.
Yeah, totally.
It is. Very strange. That's really weird.
So I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel.
What's going on?
We're all West Coast.
Yeah.
So we're all currently sitting in, I think this is the south wing of the Strong Estate
in
beautiful Los Angeles. The servants have just dropped off some delicious sourdough bread. Mm.
There are no servants, but the bread is real and it was good.
So I owe the listeners an apology.
Oh, the listeners, not me.
Not Ryder, no. I owe the listeners of America an apology. I don't remember when it was. It was a couple episodes back. Mm-hmm. And Ryder was going on and on and on and on about his new artisanal bread making.
Is that really how it happened?
It was something like...
through Todd's memory.
You brought it up.
I was boring everybody with bread making. That's...
Ryder was like, after Trump won, I was like, we're going to have to take it out to the woods. And I started making bread. But Julie and I were just sitting at Ryder's table in his kitchen with his lovely wife, Alex, and I noticed some tinfoil covering something on the counter.
You're really drawing this out. Ate bread.
I sliced you some of my bread that I baked last night. I put it in a toaster.
The key is he didn't offer it to us initially. I had to ask our host, what's that under the tinfoil? Mm-hmm. And then Ryder pulled the tinfoil back and revealed to us a loaf of sourdough bread of a golden brown variety.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
About the length of your arm.
Yeah. It was bread, everybody. It looked like a loaf of bread.
And Ryder then cut us each a piece using an ivory-handled knife.
This episode's going to be 4 hours.
He popped it into his toaster. And within 3 minutes, Julia and myself both had a delicious piece of super sour sourdough bread covered in soft, buttery butter.
Oh my God.
It was really good.
It was fucking delicious. Yeah, it was really good.
Great job.
Yeah, how long did it take you to prepare?
Well, that's a difficult question. This is the thing about baking bread is like you have to plan basically like 24 hours in advance. Mm-hmm. You have to set this out for a while and let it sit for 8 hours and then knead this and fold that and let that sit for... So it's been I have a starter, a little bread starter that I have to feed every 2 days.
Yeah.
I let the starter die.
Most
people don't. But that's why I didn't know what any of this meant either. I never understood why there was like good sourdough and then why most of the bread that we eat is shitty bread.
Right.
And, like, now I understand because it takes a lot of time and patience and
it's planning. An ancient art.
Yes.
It was delicious though.
It was super good.
So Julia is here on the West Coast.
Yeah.
To visit friends and record with us.
Yeah. You guys are also friends that I'm visiting.
Right.
To be clear.
Where have you been this far?
Oh, I've been to Seattle.
What'd you see in Seattle?
It was so lovely. I've been there so many times. Seattle's awesome. I went down to Pike Place Market by myself. I went, my friend and I on our big tour.
Did you get a pierogi? There's a really good pierogi place in Pike Place Market.
No, I didn't. I had crepes and they were very good.
Those are good.
And, I did the regular Seattle stuff, but then, mostly I was hanging out with friends, like, taking long walks in the park, and then a friend of mine worked on rebranding Smith Tower, which is this historic tower, and she, was a big part of rebranding this, rooftop bar and observatory that is now, like, Prohibition-era drinks.
Oh, cool.
So
it's really cool. Yeah. But, you know, Seattle, it was nice for one day, and then it rained for four. It was great. And then I drove through Washington and Oregon, and then I stopped in Redding, California, and went into the mountains to see my friend in her Buddhist retreat.
Did you see the Buddha?
No. No, he was not there.
Did you see the llama?
It's not a silent retreat.
Is it one of those retreats where you get to talk?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean... It's a place where people live and pray and do that. And then they go on, like, mini retreats in the woods, which is very beautiful. Northern California, that's where...
What was the group sex situation?
I didn't have any. I wasn't invited to have any.
It still could have been that.
Yeah, no, so, yeah. I just want to, like, be clear, like, I only saw from my own personal lens.
Right.
And then I drove here.
And Ryder and I just did the LA Times Festival of Books, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
We had a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I only participated in one panel. How many panels did you end up
hosting? I was on two panels, and then I did a bunch of book signings and stuff while I was there also. But Ryder actually got pulled in as a pinch hitter. The writer Jason Diamond, who wrote a book called Searching for John Hughes, got in a car accident before the panel in New York.
Mm.
And the nice folks at the LA Times were like, "Can you get us Ryder Strong?"
I'm sure that's how it went.
It was like... "Hey, Todd, could your friend Ryder do it?" And I was like, "Yeah,
he's
probably
busy making bread, but...
he has a starter he has to feed."
So Ryder came in and pinch hit on this very cool panel we did, actually, with the author of Brad Pack America, Kevin Smokler, about 80s pop culture and nostalgia and movies. And
a lot of the things we're probably going to
talk
about.
Wow, so you guys just starting did this episode. Minutes.
Yeah.
Well, in some ways, I hadn't read the book yet, to be honest. Cool. I started reading it on Sunday, so I'm... this is all still kind of fresh to me. But meeting Kevin was great.
He's he was cool.
Very, very cool guy and funny as hell, but also able to speak very eloquently, as he is able to write very eloquently about pop culture in the 80s.
And the other person that was on the panel was a French writer named Simon Roy. Mm-hmm. In my mind, his name was Simon Roy. Mm-hmm. And so it was difficult for me during the course of the day to not just call him Simon Roy. So every time I said his name...
Called him Simon a couple times during the Simon. No, he didn't really care. Because actually asked him, and he was like,
"It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Tout à l'heure, toujours, toujours." If you're listening, Simone, we're sorry about that.
I don't know why you use this podcast to reveal the dumb things you think.
Oh my God.
That's the whole point of this podcast, is to get a glimpse into our heads.
Guys.
All the dumb things we think.
Can I tell you about the greatest moment of my weekend?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. I had two great moments. But the first was I met Congressman John Lewis.
Oh, you? Oh yeah, I saw.
So here's how it happened.
What was he doing there? Does he have a book out?
The graphic novel.
March. Yeah. So he was up for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for his graphic novel March, which he lost to... another person who was British.
So it's a civil rights graphic novel? Oh my God, I gotta check this out.
Yeah, it's his autobiography, essentially. It's a graphic novel.
That's amazing.
And he won the National Book Award for it.
Wow. So.
But he lost the National Book Award. Yeah, he seems to be doing fine. He was there in the auditorium where all the authors were seated. So all the authors sit on the bottom floor, and then the unwashed masses sit upstairs to watch. And so as we were walking out, I was like, I gotta see where John Lewis is. I gotta meet him. And so I'm like, where is he? And I turn and look, and he's standing right next to me. And John Lewis is like, he's like 5'2".
Mm-hmm.
He's a wee little man. He's like the size of one of those little aliens in Galaxy Quest. He's tiny. And that's right. I compared.
That's the reference we're going with.
I was going to say when
I've seen him in photos standing next to Martin Luther King Jr., but let's go with your reference.
He's just tiny.
What aliens are you talking about?
The miners. Not the miners. So we're walking out. I was like, oh my God. And my friend Elizabeth Crane, who we had on the show a couple years ago, she really wanted to meet him too. And she was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do it. Mm-hmm. And so John Lewis is right next to me, and Betsy Crane is right in front of me. And so I smack Betsy on the back, and I'm hitting her on the back to show her that John Lewis is right there. The Congressman John Lewis, the man who believes in everything that we believe in, is right next to her. And so I'm smacking her, and she's like, "Todd, what?" And she turns the wrong direction, and I'm like, over there, and pointing. She's like, wow, wow, wow. And then she sees John Lewis, and she freezes up. And what she does is she throws herself against the wall and lets him pass. I couldn't let that happen.
No, of course not.
So what I did was he was trying to leave. And so I screamed, Congressman Lewis.
Yes.
Mr. Congressman. And then he turned around. And I said, I just want to shake your hand. And he said, oh, okay. And so I shook his hand. And I said, I just want to thank you for everything you have done for America and everything you do every day. And I want you to know that I'm behind you and everything. And then I just started babbling and getting teary-eyed. Okay. And he just kept saying, I'm just doing my job. I'm just doing my job. Oh, you know, God. You go out and what you do is important. And he was talking and I was getting teary-eyed and it was just going on and on and on. And I'm not letting go of his hand.
Oh, great.
Oh, you're that guy.
Yeah. And then I was like, well, I need to get a picture. And so I just turned around and there's just this guy standing there. I was like, take my picture. And this guy was like, all right. And so, like, normally, like, you take a picture, you take, like, 3, 4, 5, 6 pictures.
Yeah,
like, you
no, just keep just, it. Like, bang.
He just was like, pop, here you go.
Well, it was a nice picture. I saw
it. It was a good picture, yeah.
Yeah.
But I met Congressman John Lewis.
That's fantastic.
It was history.
Yeah.
History. But then, I wasn't there for this. He came into the author green room at the book festival, and which writer can attest is like, Barnes & Noble come to life. But he came in at the close of business on Saturday.
Wait, is Barnes & Noble fake? Like, what?
It's like every author in the world comes to life.
Oh, I see.
But so he came in at the end of the day on Saturday, and I guess there's about 30 people left in there, including my friend David Ewan. And John Lewis walked into the green room, and everyone stood up and gave him a standing ovation, a round of applause. And John Lewis looked every single person in the eye and said, you must continue to do what you do. What you do is important. Go out there and change the world.
Wow.
And everyone cried.
That's beautiful.
That's yeah. Great.
Oh.
And you missed it.
And I missed that because I was at the churro cart.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's classic. Wow.
I like
that's
churros.
The full Todd Goldberg experience.
Yeah. I also shamed myself in front of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but we didn't need to go into that.
Oh. Seems sincerely sad about that.
It just
didn't go well. If the John Lewis story is a meeting going well,
we can all just
imagine what the Kareem.
The Kareem thing ended up that 5 seconds later, as I was squealing in the bathroom, Kareem came into the bathroom.
That is, you know,
so
that
you were
is...
fangirling out about him, and he walked on you.
So
that's pretty great.
The fantastic author Chris Farnsworth and I met Kareem at the same moment. Then we ran to the bathroom and were screaming and peeing and then Kareem came into the bathroom.
Well, I would say that's something out of a teen movie, to be honest with
there
you.
There we go. Segway.
And your drive through California is the stuff of the teen movie as well.
Right, that's what I was originally going to say. It was like when we're talking about location.
Yeah.
So let's turn to this book, Rat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies by Kevin Smokler. It's basically... I mean, it's kind of a series of separate essays in a lot of ways. And he groups together books mostly based on location, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say like that's the real collective theme of all of the study, I guess you would call this book, is location and setting and how important location is to the 80s teen movie. And then also where they actually filmed these movies.
Right.
What'd you guys think?
Well, I loved the book. And I loved it even before I loved meeting Kevin. So there's that bias. But, you know, I have been in a book like this. I wrote an essay for a book about John Hughes called Don't You Forget About Me.
Mm-hmm.
Where writers talked about the effect of John Hughes' movies on them. But this is not like what I thought it was going to be. I mean, this is closer to... Pictures from a Revolution than it is Tara Eisen's book Reel to Reel that we reviewed a long time ago.
It's not nearly as personal.
It's
more of a film studies book.
It is academic for sure. But I think what he does with Place is really fascinating. Like, I didn't know anything about the fake city that exists in all the John Hughes movies. I was fascinated by his examination of the different parts of Los Angeles in teen movies, and then all the stuff that happens in the Pacific Northwest. I think what Kevin does really well is contextualizes what the teen movie was at that time and why it's mm-hmm. important. And we should note that what he defines as the 80s teen movie era begins actually in 1979 with Breaking Away and ends with Heathers, which was 1989. So I was really into it. I mean, this is sort of my sweet spot. Like, if reading this book would be equal to like reading an Elmer Leonard book for me, it's like, oh, that's great. Give me some more.
Well, that's true. This is actually worth pointing out. Like, we are all at very different ages when we explored mm-hmm. these movies. And I'm curious because I actually was surprised how few of these films I had seen.
Huh.
I've only seen the main ones. And like movies, even like classics like Heathers, I've only seen once. And, it's been 20 years since I've seen Heathers. So, Todd, you're like the prime 80s age.
Yeah,
like,
I saw all these movies.
You saw them in the theaters, is the point, right? Like, you actually remember going to see them. See, I was born in 79, so for me, I saw these films mostly on VHS or way after the fact. I missed every single John Hughes film until I was in my teens, which would have put me watching them in the mid-90s, which partly, I think, is why I don't like John Hughes films. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't give a shit about them. But I have to say, even if you don't like 80s teen movies, this this book is really a good read. Like, it's actually, he loves these films, obviously.
Right.
But he's also, he's not blinded by them. He has a very good critical eye on what's wrong with a lot of these films. But anyway, Julia, have you seen any of these
films? So I have seen, I mean, I would say for the listeners, like a lot of these movies, I would assume like everyone has seen. So there's a lot of early, there's a whole chapter or two on the lead up. So there's a lot about Jaws and Grease. And then of course, like Back to the Future, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club. Like, yeah. So there's, even if you were to get this book and like, just kind of peruse those chapters. Like these are classics, for the most part. Well, not for the most part, maybe about like a third of them. But I think it's very telling. Oh, Dirty Dancing too.
Yeah.
Karate Kid.
Yeah.
But then also there's this whole section, 80s teen movies set in the 50s.
Yes. So that I want to go back to that. That was my favorite section.
Me too.
But I will say like of all these movies, and there's several that I really like, in particular Dirty Dancing and Back to the Future, very telling for my age, by far my favorite of all these movies is Heathers. So, like, the coda on this era, like, the little, like, transition moment that led to, like, Scream and Clueless and Mean Girls, like, that is...
Because it's kind of the deconstruction
of the 80s teen. And it's like they're, I mean, we're skipping right to the end, but it's saying, essentially, like, what 80s movies missed is this, like, darkness, this hilarious darkness. So... For me, like, I really like this book. It was so much better written than I would say it even had to be. Like, he really obviously cares so much about these movies, and particularly the locations.
Yeah.
It's like, that is the thesis, is that these movies, like, create an idea of an America that, you know, we all nostalgize or kind of live in or whatever. There's a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of, like, do I feel like these movies... changed my life, changed my world. Maybe they made my world, but I don't think they changed my world.
You know what is interesting is I didn't know until I got to the end of this book that the guy who made Heathers, his brother made Mean Girls, which I've watched probably.
They're the same.
800,000 times.
Heathers or Mean Girls?
Both. But Mean Girls more recently because Wendy, my wife, watches Mean... Like, if Mean Girls is on, it's on. Like, we're watching it.
Yeah.
But Mean Girls, like, you can see, like, the direct line from Heathers to it without knowing that, that they're related.
Oh, yeah. Whenever I encounter teenagers who are like, I love Mean Girls is, like, old and retro now to them, and I'm like...
When did Mean Girls come out? 2000,
I would say, like, 2002 or 2003.
Yeah. Okay. Because Lindsay Lohan was still upright.
Yeah.
It was so interesting for me to, like, I actually think Kevin should write a sequel book to about the 90s teen movies. Because there's a whole era of 90s teen movies that are very bizarre in their own right.
Right.
And, like, they have their own sort of set of rules and location ideas. And I would love to read that, too.
Well, and because
I think
they also
know them better, maybe.
They branch off pretty clearly from the 80s movies. Like, a 90s movie like Can't Hardly Wait, which takes its title from an 80s song, Can't Hardly Wait by The Replacements. And embodies like all the ideals of all these teen movies that we love, plus Heathers, plus all these other things. Right. You know, and it satirizes them, but still ends up with a sweet ending using all 80s music. Like, the entire movie consists of 80s music and a 90s teen movie, which is
really strange. It has the positivity of an 80s movie with the slight emo-ness of
1995. But the positivity isn't really there. I mean, I think that's one of the things that Kevin talks about a lot in the book, is that there's a lot of social stuff going on in these teen movies that, when I watched them originally, I didn't really pay attention to. But like a movie...
Well,
like,
but hold on. Let's talk about that for a second. Because I feel... Because that's my problem with the John Hughes thing. Mm-hmm. And I think he really nails that down, is that John Hughes is such a weird, insular world, you know, and it's a privileged suburban white male world. Mm-hmm. And, well, I guess Pretty in Pink is female oriented in its protagonist, but like those, and the fact that those movies spoke to so many people is bizarre to me, because they never spoke to me. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm not sure why exactly, because I think I lived a pretty, you know, privileged white kid childhood. But I definitely, watching those movies was an alienating experience for me by the time I saw them, which was, like I said, probably when I was older than your average audience. I was probably like 15. Mm-hmm. And I just never liked them. But I remember hearing about Ferris Bueller's, never liked it. And I still don't really like them. I haven't seen them recently, but like, how do you feel about them, Julia? Do you...
Yeah, I have very complicated feelings. I mean, like, Ferris Bueller is about, like, the most privileged douchey...
It is. He's such a rascal. Like, I don't know how anybody could think that
he's... And the book actually does a great job identifying this. Like, the person that I always loved in that movie is Cameron. Is this tortured sidekick.
Who also is tortured by having so much money. Like, that's the problem. Sure. His big problem is that his dad has too much money and won't let him drive the Ferrari.
This is not Kevin Smokler's fault, but I think this is, like... America's fault right now is like we're way too nostalgic for this created idea. It really upsets me, like, to a deep degree. Yeah. I mean, there's just no excuse for making like this much content about one kind of experience. Right. And I guess there was then, but the fact that we're like now in this period where we're like recycling it, I'm going to go on a tangent that I know is going to upset both of you and the listeners, is I did not like, for this reason, Stranger Things. Mm. Because
we talked about this a bunch on our little panel that we did about the nostalgia for nostalgia.
Yeah. And I was like, I have already seen this fucking thing 500 times. It's a great story. It's really well made, but like, why is the black kid not the main character? Why does Barb disappear? And that's so, so funny. Ha ha ha. Like, it's so grating and annoying if you're not one of these people who is nostalgic for this, like, very specific thing. Yep.
My relationship to Stranger Things is very complicated.
Yeah.
Because I enjoyed every single second of it. Because
it's your jam.
Oh, it's Goonies. Yeah. It's, you know, it's all those horror films from the 80s that I love.
Yeah.
But I also hated it. Like, I was so frustrated creatively by it, because to me, it's like, on one hand, like, I would love to tell this kind of story, but the fact that the style of the show also, like, okay, it's one thing to rip all your content from those movies, right?
Right.
But then also when the way the show is shot, the way it's acted, the way the soundtrack, everything is ripoff from, like, is borrowed from it. It was so frustrating to me, because it's like, well, can
but
you
that's
imagine?
Homage,
well, but it's bullshit, because it's also completely uncreative. Because the point is, like, because Spielberg and Lucas, the people who basically defined this look and feel that they're imitating, or, you know, the filmmaker like Spielberg and Lucas of the 80s, you know, the filmmakers who were making the films in the 80s, they were riffing on the things that they had seen when they were kids in the 50s and 60s, like the Saturday matinees,
right,
and
the cereals
and all that. But can you imagine if they actually shot all their movies like those cereals?
Sure.
And like only made and set them in the 50s? Yeah. And like, no, the point was they took those ideas and then made new stories like E.T., you know, set in the 80s in like towns that kids would recognize at that time. And like, why are we now making nostalgia its own sort of genre?
Yes,
like,
yes.
That is so annoying to me.
I
and
totally
it's like,
agree.
Like, tell an original story, or, you know, don't tell an original story, but don't. I can't believe that we all got suckered by it.
Well,
but I also enjoyed it.
But
so
here's,
what can I say?
Here's the thing, though, and this is something that Kevin talks about in the book, about these 80s movies that take place in the 50s. Yep. It's not the true 1950s where...
They're
the 80s 50s. It's the 80s 50s where
that's
black people...
I think that's the best chapter in this
agree.
Book.
So it's an idealized idea of the 50s, not where black people couldn't drink out of the same water fountain as
right,
you.
Right, exactly.
You know, it is... So this idea that we're recreating nostalgia... My problem with Stranger Things is the same as you guys. At some point, I was just like, well, why don't I just go watch Goonies, you know? Mm-hmm. But that didn't stop me from enjoying it because I was looking at the scenes and being like, oh, I had that board game. Or, oh, I had this. So part of it, I think the nostalgia of watching something new that has those things in it is that it shorthands your emotion. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have to do as much work with those boys to make them believable characters because we are bringing into it all of our experiences from watching E.T. or all of our experiences from... You know, staying up late at night watching Night Flight. So they have built no subtext into it. We're providing
the subtext. It's baby boomers going to see an Eagles cover band.
Exactly.
And saying, that cover band is so good. But it's like, you know what? Fuck you. Like, and of course, the Eagles suck to begin with. So
oh, wow.
So to get back to the movies, this is going to get violent. We're in person now.
I've got a peaceful, easy feeling.
Exactly.
Look, Glenn Frey died for you.
Okay. So... I think that the best, and this is, let's talk about the 50s, 80s movies. Because
that's so great.
I mean, I absolutely love Back to the Future. It's, you know, second to Heather's my favorite movie in this book. But there is no way to watch Back to the Future now at this moment in, like, American history and not be like, make America great again. Like, that is the...
Right.
That is there. That
and
is
he
there.
Links that to Reagan's Morning in America.
Exactly
and the
right.
The fact that Reagan actually referenced Back to the Future and the Union is mind-boggling. I didn't realize that.
But the movies that I was really happy were included, and one always gets the short shrift as being, like, so fun, is Dirty Dancing is actually very revolutionary. There's an abortion in it. It's about rebellion. It's a really great movie. And Hairspray, I was so happy was included.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. And there's a great interview with John Waters in here as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I don't know. What did you guys think about these 80s, 50s movies?
Like, well, I happen to love all those 80s, 50s movies. Like, Peggy Sue Got Married, which is not a teen movie. Like, that was a movie my mom and I went to together when I was living in Palm Springs. I remember it vividly. Because Kathleen Turner's 50 years old and she goes back to her high school reunion and is transported back in time. But I love Peggy Sue Got Married. It's one of my favorite, like, oh, I'm sick at home. What's on demand? Oh, Peggy Sue Got Married is.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid.
It's a great film. And it's before Kathleen Turner had that weird thing happen where she started to speak with an accent.
She always had.
Did she?
Yes. She grew up in like 14 countries or something crazy. Military family.
I think she was like Madonna and just adopted it. But Back to the Future, I love it. I don't like Back to the Future 2. I like Back to the Future 3.
So let's talk about what Kevin Smokler says about those movies, which I think what was so accurate was that they... Like, in all three of the films that he discusses, which is Back to the Future, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Stand By Me, the 80s film that harkened back to the 50s, there is a jump. There's, like, literally a non-recognition of the 60s and 70s. And I thought that was so accurate. Yeah. It's like, you're right. All of these movies pretend as if the 60s and 70s never happened.
Like, Vietnam wasn't there.
Right. And that is... That was really insightful to me, just as a sort of cultural study. It's like, why were we so obsessed in the 80s? Why, you know, and I think from a crass marketing standpoint, just the studios were thinking, well, we want to appeal to baby boomers and kids, so this is the perfect way to just sort of avoid, you know. But I do think that there's something political going on there, whether the writers of these films were aware of it or not, or the makers of these films were aware of it. There was this Make America Great nostalgia, let's go back. And... that's a little disturbing. I hadn't, you know, especially for me, because Stand By Me is like it is my favorite movie of all time, to like sort of see it through that lens and be like, oh, that is complicated. That is like a kind of a messy, and Stand By Me has other issues, like the fact that there's not a single female speaking role. Like,
none, not one.
No, there is one.
The waitress.
Yes, the waitress. Yeah. Who's lighting cherry bombs out here?
Right. That's it. That's one line. That's amazing.
It's so disturbing. But anyway, I think that, you know, I thought that chapter was really, really insightful. And I don't think I'm ever going to think about those three movies the same again.
Yeah. But he also talks about Dead Poets Society in that section too. And I think that's another one of those movies that I don't think of as a teen movie because I think of it as being a Robin Williams vehicle.
No, it's a teen movie.
But I guess it is a teen movie.
Yeah.
It's not a very good one either. I think we've talked about this before. Yeah. But like, and I think that he quotes the Ebert review of it, mm-hmm. which is totally accurate. Because, you know, they just did another a Broadway play version of it with the... who was it? Jason Segel as the professor? I don't know. Anyway, mm-hmm. And the reviews of that were basically the same, which is like, this is the safest movie about rebellion
yes.
ever.
Right.
It's like, you know, be a poet, but then you're reading Whitman?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, 150-year-old poet?
Well, here's what Roger Ebert said, that Dead Poets Society, he wrote, was a collection of pious platitudes masquerading as a courageous stand in favor of something.
Oof.
I completely agree.
The movie is set in 1959, but none of these would-be bohemians have heard of Kerouac, Ginsberg, or indeed of the Beatnik movement.
Right. There's nothing dangerous in the movie at all.
No.
But at the same time, I did like it as a kid. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think how old I was when I saw it. I guess if it came out in the 80s, I could have been under 10. I remember enjoying it, and I'm somebody who loves poetry and literature, so
it
helped influence me.
Yeah, it's emotional, you know, and they're all emotional.
89.
But I think that criticism can be pulled out to most of the movies in this book. Like, teen movies are about emotion, and they're about rebellion, but they're about rebellion and emotion in the confines of your, like, white, suburban, rich world.
Right.
You know, like... Molly Ringwald hooking up with Judd Nelson, like, ooh. You know, like, oh my God. You know?
The more frightening thing is Judd Nelson was like 47 and Molly Ringwald was 16.
But that's an interesting point, and this is something I thought about because obviously, like, I was involved in a teen show a decade later, and I remember being part of the creative process and feeling like, These old writers, you know, and they weren't that old at the time. In the 90s, like, Michael Jacobs was probably in his 40s writing Boy Meets World. But, like, it felt like they were writing a 1950s version of America for a 90s audience. And it was, you know, there's something inherently retro about adults writing for teenagers. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so there's always going to be this level of, like, they're a decade or two behind whatever they're set in. And that's, like, I think partly why... they kept writing movies set in the 50s, you know, because during the 80s, like, if you're thinking about your child, and now we're going to get a slew of 80s films, especially since Stranger Things did well, we're going to get a slew of teenage films set in the 80s and early 90s, because that's who's writing films right now, or writing TV shows, and that's what they want. Or that's how they tap into their own childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kevin's really good at sort of pointing to the limitations of John Hughes, and then also recognizing that it did reach a lot of people.
Like, right.
And I think as a craftsperson, those films are really, they're well written. You know, like, they have great structure, the dialogue is witty, the characters are interesting enough to, you know, they appeal. They were huge mainstream successes. I mean, like, I know a lot of people who were working in the entertainment industry in the 80s, and, like, everybody wanted the next John Hughes film. Mm-hmm. Like, that was, like, for about 10 years in Hollywood, like, every screenplay that was sold had to be the next John Hughes, because he was, like, the voice for a while there, because all of his movies didn't cost that much, made a crap ton of money, and really spoke to kids across the nation.
And he had huge merchandising. All of those soundtracks were top 10 records.
Right.
Which is, I think, is something, too. But you know what's interesting is, sort of the precursor to the John Hughes in a movie that he talks about to a large extent is Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which is a far more serious film than any of the John Hughes films. All the John Hughes films have an element of surreal that doesn't exist in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
They're also sentimental.
Right.
Like, Fast Times isn't sentimental.
No.
But remember, it's crass. Mm-hmm. Like, it's more crass. There's more nudity and sex. And it's also just a little edgier. There's just this level of, like, I don't know if these kids are going to be all right. Or, you know, whereas John Hughes, it's like, it's always wrapped up in a nice, sweet little bow. And, like, you just kind of feel good at the end of...
Yeah, but Fast Times is a dirty movie.
It's dirty.
You know? And it takes place, you know, Spicoli... I heard Kevin actually talking about Spicoli on a radio interview in my car, like, 3 weeks ago. And talking about how everyone, and he talks about this in the book also, how everyone in Fast Times at Ridgemont High had a job, except for Spicoli.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Spicoli is the last person, the last bohemian left. He just wants some tasty waves, cool bud.
And he's happier because
he's happy.
Points out in this book, right.
But he's just... He is not driven by anything related to money or status.
I hadn't thought about it because Amy Heckerling talks about how Fast Times was about kids growing up too fast.
Right.
And, like, I hadn't really seen the movie through that lens. But, yeah, it's true. They all have jobs. They're, like, this sort of precious zone of childhood has been taken over by these adult expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is a pressure that they're feeling. That's a cool way to read that movie. I had never thought of it.
I thought it was just like a
oh, she's teen a romp, yeah. you know? She's but, like, she is obviously a genius because, I mean, I think Clueless is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Like, I agree.
Which I didn't recognize at the time. Like, I saw Clueless in the theater, and I was like, this movie's so dumb. Right? Well, I just remember thinking, like, I thought, and I'm sure that this is true to a certain extent, you know, the whole, like, bad viewer theory? Mm-hmm. Like, there's people. I think I watched Clueless thinking that we were supposed to think that she's funny and heroic in a way. Like, I was completely misreading the satire of the film. But I think a lot of people, like, in their teens in the 90s were doing that and didn't realize until later, like, oh, I love this movie, but I'm supposed to also be laughing at this person, you know?
Right.
Which is something that John Hughes is not quite there. Like, there's a moment in this book where, I don't think it's Kevin himself, but somebody makes a reference to Lena Dunham in reference to John Hughes and how the sort of limited worldview of a privileged person writing about their privileged world. And I think that that's a fair assessment in some ways, but I would say Lena Dunham's aware of it. Like, that's the whole point. Like, she, you know, the beginning of Girls...
There's more satire in Girls than people
Yeah, I mean, the very opening of Girls is we're cutting you off of your money, and it's like, clearly she's meant to be this anti-hero, whereas I'm not sure... Like, Ferris Bueller, I think, is actually kind of meant to be a hero. Like, I think we're supposed to see that his, like, rebellion is, like, sticking it to his parents in some cool... Or sticking it to the principal.
And, like, you know, I saw that movie when I was 16 years old.
Loved it.
And I was like, oh, that's what I'm going to be.
Yeah. Great.
All I need is a camera crew to follow me around so I can talk to the camera.
Yeah. Like, when it was like 16 or 17 years old, like my senior year in high school, I was like, oh, I can write my own doctor's notes. I can be Ferris Bueller. I mean, do whatever I want.
You know, there's so a certain horrible joy in that. But, you know, I think this is really important. It's like, there's so many things in John Hughes movies that, listen, I think they're not, like, so inexcusable, though, we should, like, not watch them. But, like, if we constantly dig down into this nostalgia, we are purposefully blinding ourselves to certain really terrible things. I mean, Kevin does really hard work that I don't think is deserved trying to justify Long Duck Dong.
That's just racist.
The actor who plays him.
Which is a great idea.
Yeah.
Right, and it's an interesting interview, and it is... The comedy is clearly based on trafficking and stereotypes. Yeah. And there's no way around
it. And, you know, Kevin and the actor both say, like, oh, and they satirize, like, grandmas and stuff, but it's not the same. And the other thing that's really, you know, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, but Pretty in Pink. Is that the one with Ducky? Is that the one with Ducky?
Yeah.
So that whole idea that there's this, like, underdog nerd and he, like, deserves the girl and it's, like, fucked up that he doesn't get her is so toxic. That's just like different kinds of men fighting over an idealized woman. And like, we have to, at a certain point, you know, like, put the gate down. Like, yes, it is the character chooses the guy she wants to be with, and that's good. You know, there can't be like a whole culture around like, oh, she should have gotten with the nerd. She should have been with him. You know, and these things are like, we can't nostalgize that because that's what creates men who like feel like, they see themselves as that kind of character and that they are like are owed something from the hot, beautiful girls.
Right. Yeah, and so sometimes I feel like the way Kevin's approaching John Hughes is like the way some, you know, Shakespeare scholars approach Shakespeare, where it's like they're excusing shit. You're like, can we just say he was anti-Semitic?
Yeah, exactly.
There's some shit in here that's pretty... Or Shakespeare, he created Lady Macbeth. That's great, but he also wrote Taming of the Shrew.
Right.
Like, let's recognize the sexism of his era and of his time and not like say overall he was a feminist.
Like, exactly. Do that. So like at the very end, so like a perfect example, and again, I really like this book and I really like Kevin, even though I've never met him, but like there's a line that like completely summarizes this, and he's like, well, there are some things from the 80s we should leave behind, like shoulder pads and casual sexism. I'm like, those are not the same. Like, one of those ruins lives. Like, and I feel like that
yeah,
is...
Yeah, but that's just someone writing something funny. In
well,
it.
He was being clever.
He was being clever.
Yes,
but
that's my point. It's like, so I both agree, and it's also like a good example of just like sliding through something that has like truly ruined... world,
people's lives,
you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's hard to be like, that's bad, but even that line is nostalgic, you know? Like, there's still a nostalgia in that criticism.
So the other thing I think to talk about in this book is the one thing we actually haven't talked about, which is his sense of place. Like, this entire book is based on cities and and why certain teen movies are based in Chicago or LA or the nebulous New England.
Which I have to say, I thought it was really interesting, and I think there's some really great points, but overall it feels like a kind of... like I when I got to the end of the book and I realized that he had written a lot of these as essays, individual essays, it made a lot of sense to me, because I feel like the location setting question becomes the linkage between these different essays. I don't know if it always holds up, because it's really, it's a kind of, you know, like one of the major points he makes in the beginning is that the 80s teen movie was a time when we moved away from the coasts and started focusing. But that doesn't end up being true, because like 90% of the movies he talks about take place in Los Angeles.
Right.
So it's kind of like, so I felt like that was, it was a really good argument to be making when you're talking about John Hughes. Like that, that he was trying to like center childhood outside of the coast, like into a suburban Midwestern. Like, yes, that makes perfect sense. Outside of that, I'm not sure the argument holds up as a frame for the entire book. I think that the biggest organizing principle is 80s and popular culture.
Right.
Like, the, you know, trying to make a theoretical argument about setting it didn't quite succeed for
me. Well, and there's the point, like, when he's talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure taking place in San Dimas, which I was just driving through about 35 minutes ago. And when I was a kid, I mean, I grew up 45 minutes from San Dimas, and so whenever we would drive by San Dimas, you know, en route to Raging Waters Water Park, we'd all say, "San Dimas High School Football rules!" Like, we would say that. And then to find out, while reading the book, that it was all shot in Phoenix. Even having been to that city, I didn't even recognize that it wasn't actually San Dimas. And so, and this is a word I learned from Ryder, it's a
simulacra.
It's a simulacra of the...
or simulacrum.
Simulacrum of the suburbia that they're trying to capture, but not even shooting in that particular place. So that San Dimas is a fictionalized San Dimas that is shot in Arizona.
I don't
Arizona.
Know if I care, though. I really don't know if I care.
Yeah, me neither.
Like, I don't care that they're... I mean, like, I think I care about... I think I care about John Hughes creating a fictional town. Like, that's interesting, because that's like a regionalist project on par with, like, Faulkner creating a fake county. And I think that's interesting that he linked all his movies together. That's really cool. Outside of that, the argument kind of falls apart for me. Like, I don't give a shit where a movie was actually shot. And I think that there are times when the fictional setting is worth exploring. Like, why did they choose this town? Or why did they choose the fictional setting? But, like, he spends a lot of time just on, like, that trivia that you're talking about. Like, this is where it was really shot. This is where it didn't exist. I don't know if I care. Like, I mean, I care maybe from, like, a filmmaking, like, historical perspective. But, like, as in terms of, like, the better theory arguments he's making about, like, Reagan America or the coastal elites or, like, what... I would much rather just stick to those theoretical...
Right.
I feel like it was a little bit of work done, maybe because of a publisher saying, there's got to be a connection tissue between all of these essays, and that became the thing. I'm not sure if that holds up as a cohesive...
Yeah, I don't always... Like, if you ask me, where does Stand By Me take place? Where does Back to the Future take place? I would be like, I have no idea.
Right. Well, see, Stand By Me spoke to me because it looked like my childhood, because I grew up in Northern California, it took place in Oregon. But again, he also avoids the fact that it actually was written in Maine.
Yeah.
And like Stephen King, so the fact that it was able to be transplanted to this other town means it's kind of flexible where the location is.
And same thing with Dead Poets Society, like we don't ever really know where Dead Poets Society is.
And I feel like Kevin kind of has it both ways, right? Because sometimes he says location is all that matters, and then other times he says like it doesn't really matter here because it's a theoretical space.
But like when he's talking about Los Angeles of the mid-1980s after the Olympics or before the Olympics.
Oh, that was a good...
That was a really sort of fascinating examination of this city at a particular time.
That's true.
And it's also interesting when he's looking at movies like Repo Man, that period of Los Angeles in the mid-1980s is... It's like 7 years before shit just blew up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, with Rodney King and everything.
Right.
And so the mid-80s in LA was, you know, brought rise to the popularization of punk rock music, but it also brought us the popularization of West Coast gangster rap.
Mm-hmm.
All these things that were happening at the same time as these movies were being made in the shadow of the 1984 Olympics. I mean, I would love to see Kevin write a book about the movies that came out 1 year after the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of looking at the socioeconomics of everything, that I was really fascinated by. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's also because I was here, you know?
Right. Right, because what about, like, this whole section on New York and the hip-hop movies?
Yeah.
I haven't seen a single one of
them. Oh, I saw all of them.
You've seen them all.
Yeah,
okay.
I saw them all.
I haven't seen a single one of those movies. And, like, some... I mean, he admits, like, one of them wasn't really a big hit, but, like, I mean, I had heard of Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, yeah. I saw Wild Style. I saw Beat Street. I saw House Party. I saw Crush Groove.
See, that's what I mean. I hadn't seen a lot of... I haven't seen Breaking Away. I haven't seen Valley Girl.
You've never seen Valley Girl?
Nope.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen... near the end of this book, there was a whole section on movies that I'd never... Oh, I've never seen The Outsiders.
Never seen The Outsiders?
That's what I mean. Like, mostly reading this book...
So if I were to say
I've
to
never
you...
seen War Games.
If I were
I've
to say this
seen...
to you, Stay Gold, Pony Boy, you wouldn't know what I'm saying?
Nope.
Oh, my God.
No.
Oh my God! I just bought a signed copy of The Outsiders at the book festival.
Never seen Repo Man, Some Kind of Wonderful Suburbia.
Oh my! Something Wild is a fundamental text in my life. Ugh. It's about, you know, people pretending to be other people, essentially. Hmm. Oh, I love that movie. Repo Man also is very important to me.
I mean, it's absolutely true. Like where you're from. I mean, the location that speaks to me the most is Amity, the fake beach town on the Cape.
Oh, right.
And that is a really interesting location because it talks about it couldn't be so nice that one shark could destroy the shark jaws.
Yeah.
One shark could just. It had to be like kind of shitty.
Right.
And that is an example of like, yes, that was such a good location. Choice and idea, because if you had said like it's on Nantucket or mm-hmm. P-town, and people would be like, what, there's sharks all the time,
right.
But yeah,
well, and I guess, you know, looking at the map, so there's a map at the back of the book that shows where every movie takes place that he talks about, and really we're talking about major metropolitan areas. Basically every place Trump won, there was no teen movie made.
Wow, that's an interesting thought.
I mean, it's true. So, like, you know, from Wisconsin and Minnesota all the way to down to Texas, basically, until two bad, terrible movies, Johnny B. Goode and The Legend of Billie Jean.
Also, never seen either one of those.
Johnny B. Goode is a football movie starring Anthony Michael
Hall.
Horrible,
right?
It's dreadful.
That's okay. That's the only movie that he actually says, this is a horrible movie.
It's a horrible movie.
Which is fascinating.
Horrible movie. And there's only one movie that takes place in Florida, and that's Caddyshack. And I don't consider Caddyshack a teen movie. I think that's a bit of a stretch. But, you know, it is primarily, you know, there's Washington and Oregon and California and a lot of stuff in Chicago, obviously, because it's the John Hughes movies. But the middle of the country is not represented at all.
No.
At all.
That's interesting.
Unless
you count Chicago as the middle of the country.
Well, I mean, it is the technical middle. I guess I'm talking about the Great Plains.
Sure.
Which I don't really know where those are. Now, there's never been a single movie in the 80s that took place in Tennessee, however.
Oh, there's gotta be.
In the South, actually.
No.
Besides Caddyshack and a little bit of Texas. Hmm. Well, yeah. Overall, I think that, I think this is a really fun book.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people would get a kick out of it. But I do think that, like, we're gonna, and we talked about this on the panel a little bit, we're in an interesting time where a generation that grew up with access to film at home is now writing books and being critics in a way that never really happened before. Like, you know, we were able to watch movies on VHS over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Previous generations of children didn't grow up with that kind of... So films are now becoming serious texts that we have to take seriously as in terms of their influence on our lives and then on the culture at large. And I think more and more of these kinds of studies are going to come out. And I love this stuff. I mean, I think it's really important to, take these texts seriously. I wish that Kevin could take it even more seriously. I'm sure that there's pressure to sell a book like this and to just, you know, appeal to your average, you know, person walking through a bookstore at the airport and be like, oh, a book about movies I like, I'll buy it. But I think that there's some really great serious film studies points that are made in here contribute to the conversation, the critical conversation about how we think about film in general and these movies in particular that I really enjoy.
But you know what I wonder is if... these kinds of books are going to come out in 10 or 15 years when movies of today are picked apart so minutely already on the internet. Like there was no place in 1987 to pick apart Breakfast Club frame by frame by frame.
Mm-hmm.
But every single movie that comes out right now online is completely examined. And there's a TikTok of every place, every set.
Yeah, but most of those conversations are like fan fiction or like fan theories. Like that's a different. That's like a different thing than what Kevin. I mean, Kevin obviously has an element of his book that's like that, but But I thought, like, that's kind of what I'm saying, is that I like the more theoretical sort of like broader view, academic, I guess more academic approach to it, which is not, I don't think, what's happening online. But
well, I've read at least, I'm not exaggerating, like 20 really good pieces on Get Out. Is, and there's a reason for that, which is that it's doing something new, so people were very excited, and a lot of good outlets wanted to write about it.
It's also kind of easy. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
To write about, like,
yes,
it's, it's kind of like writing about sexism in Mad Men. It's like, well, that's the point of this.
Sure, but that's why this thing exists. So I think
that's why Get Out exists.
What's different than what you're saying, Todd, and what this book does is linking movies together over time, seeing what lasted, what didn't. I mean, like, why did Back to the Future, why is that, like, so huge as compared to, like, The Outsiders or something?
Right.
You know what I mean? So those are the kind of studies I think we'll be looking at long term.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that is a great point. Like, Outsiders is not our popular culture like Back to the Future is. Back to the Future is, I've seen Back to the Future 500 times.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. You know, there's never a time that Back to the Future has been on television when I haven't stopped to watch it for 10 minutes.
And it's actually, it's a perfect movie. Like, and it's also, you know, I think, like, his points about it sort of leaping over the 60s and 70s is really interesting. But he also points out, like, it's critical of the Reagan era in a very astute and sly way.
Right.
And I think that, that movie holds up. In all regards.
He makes that great point about when Marty comes back, downtown in that city is still crappy. The bum is still the bum.
Yeah.
But his parents are more affluent, and the house they live in is nicer.
Right.
But the world has not fundamentally changed for those people that are on the fringes, which I think is, you know, that's some trenchant filmmaking by Bob Zemeckis. So,
good book.
If you're a fan of 80s movies, if you're a fan of just interesting film criticism, Brat Pack America by Kevin Smogler. And I also have to give a plug for his first book, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School.
Sounds cool.
Which is essentially what we do every week right here.
Yeah, I was going to say. Reading books is important, but I want to check that out.
It's a great book. And Kevin's really funny. If you get to see him in person, Ryder and I had a great time with him on this panel at the book festival.
All right, guys. Well, it was great recording with you in the same room.
So fun. I hope we came up with all new technical problems for Tucker.
I got to tell you, though, I didn't realize but neither of you wore pants when we did this live.
Oh, yeah. That's part of it.
Yeah.
And you're not wearing anything except the gold chain.
No, and it's not around my neck.